Unless you're trying to do a blooper reel.
Well, no, I don't keep the stuff, the extra stuff. Honest to goodness, John, I don't keep it.
Okay.
Because I wouldn't want it to fall into the wrong hands. Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your hosts, Jorn Sutai Vampir and Jajim Vestai Jajim, will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Welcome to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Book Review Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Jim.
And I am Jorn. Deal with it.
And today we are talking about a book called The Left Hand of Destiny, Book 2. By J.G. Hertzler and Jeffrey Lang, published in May of 2003.
And if you haven't gone through the first book yet, Book 1, The Left Hand of Destiny, Book 1, if you haven't gone through that book yet, why haven't you?
Yeah.
Go back to the other podcast right before this one and listen to it. God darn it, you don't know what's going to happen in this one if you haven't listened to the last one.
Oh, yeah.
Get off your duffs. Be a Klingon. Do it.
The last one, the first book sets up everything for the second book. So you really can't read one without the other. So, you know, that's very valid.
Well, you can, but if you did, JG would have probably track you down and hound you for the next 50 years of your life.
Yes, you don't want the Chancellor angry at you. That's not a good thing.
Well, as we've said already, and beat into the ground, this is book two of a two-book story, two-book arc. The summary on the back tells you about the plot is, I'm going to start reading now. Pay very, very, very close attention. Or not. The true test of a warrior is not without, it is within. The sins of the past collide with the hopes for the future as Martok fights for the right to lead the Klingon Empire. With the secret of his usurper exposed. That, people, was the last book which you were supposed to have read and listened to.
Mm-hmm.
Get off your duffs and do it.
Mm-hmm.
The ousted Chancellor and his ragtag band of followers embark on a desperate plan to retake the Empire. But while Worf, Ezra Dax, and the crew of the IKS Wotaran go in search of the Klingon's most revered icon of power, Martok is dealt the most crushing blow of all, driving him to make his final stand on the ice-strewn cliffs of the sacred Borath, as that frozen planet reverberates with the song of armies and battles clashing. The mystery of Martok's past and the future of the Klingon Empire is revealed!
Wow, you read that very well.
Yeah, I'll be dramatic about it. Probably doesn't, you know, probably turned everybody off by now and they've all gone home.
Well, you know, that one listener, we got to take care of them.
Yeah, please, please keep listening.
Yeah, don't stop.
Okay, overall impressions. Again, I have to ask the question of why do the Herc not inspire instinctual fear in the Klingon warriors? I mean, they were conquered by these guys.
Mm-hmm.
They were held captive. They were looted. They were made slaves. Why do the Klingon warriors that see the Herc coming at them not at least feel the urge to flee? Or at least, why isn't that discussed? Why isn't it pointed out that Klingons have evolved beyond that fear, have dealt with fear, and this is how they react to the Herc? You know, it's just, I really think that should have been dealt with gone into a bit more. And next, how do Ezri, Worf, and Alexander have any idea whatsoever where to look for the Sword of Kalis? I mean, space is big. You just won't believe how vastly, hugely, mind-bogglingly big it is. I mean, you think it's a long way down the road to the chemist, but that's just peanuts compared to space. And for those of you who remember these things, yes, that's a quote from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. But it's still really big.
Okay. Now, before you move on, I'm going to address this with you. Of course, it's mind-bogglingly big, but we also have to remember that this is kind of an Arthurian kind of story, the way it's been put together, and you can't just have some watery tart distributing scimitars to the people as they pass by. yeah, hey, really.
Jim, there's some lovely muck over here.
So, yeah. Well, there's got to be magic involved with it anyway.
I mean, that's the only way you can really explain it, because space is just huge.
Well, yeah. And
you're trying to find a 4 foot long by 2 foot wide object in billions and billions, to quote Carl Sagan, miles.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, yeah. Kor beamed it off of the runabout.
Actually, I think it was Jadzia, because Kor and Worf wouldn't have been able to.
Ah, but...
And we're going to get to that later on when I start talking about how Martok treats the sword.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, it's just floating around out there. And according to the story, of course, it apparently got absorbed into a comet.
Which makes it even harder to find.
What, didn't the story say they were scanning for a substance that wouldn't normally be found in a comet? And that's basically how they found it?
I think if you're scanning for something that's normally not found in a comet, you're probably detecting every third comet.
Yeah. All right, well, you have a third point.
Okay, the sword. They get the sword. They rescue the sword. They give it to Martok. Martok uses it for a moment in the final battles with his son. But he breaks his son's sword, and he feels that it would be unfair for him to push the battle to its logical conclusion at that point. Has his troops give his son another Batleth, then drives the Sword of Kalis into the snow, picks up another Batleth to face him on equal terms.
Mm-hmm.
Worf and Kor could not give up the Sword of Kalis for any reason whatsoever when they did the episode of the Sword of Kalis.
Mm-hmm.
How does Martok put it down, and why does Martok treat the sword differently? And frankly, at the end, I think he gives the sword to Kalis, doesn't he? He doesn't even keep it.
Yeah.
Which goes against the feelings that are reflected in that particular Deep Space Nine episode.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Well, if I'd have been Worf, I would have been a little upset. It's like, we went all through this, and you aren't going to use this.
Well, more importantly, look, it's over there in the snow, standing up. Martok's not using it.
Mm-hmm.
I think I will.
Yeah.
Now, I can understand Alexander resisting it because, you know, he's not as steeped in Klingon tradition and Klingon lore and has handled it as much, but not Worf.
Right. So my overall impressions is it's a good book, you know. It's a resolution to the first book where all seemed lost for Martok before he had even had a chance to really assume his duties as Chancellor. You know, we thought he had lost everything in Volume 1, but in this book, he absolutely does lose everything when Sirella is killed. But, you know, the thing is about Sirella, in death, she's even more of an inspiration to him than she was in life. So I just thought it was a real epic kind of a story.
Including her return.
Yes.
Now, to fill listeners in, Sorella doesn't really return like you would see in a comic book. But Gavmara has rigged it up so somebody who will look like Sorella appears to try and distract Martok from finishing Gavmara off.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't work. Doesn't work. But yeah, no, that was one of the saddest moments in this book, was Sorella.
Actually, I have to disagree with you. That wasn't a moment that got me to tear up. It was the Ferengi. It was Farr's death that kind of teared me up. Because they had gone to he had done something really, really heroic, and died because of it.
Yeah.
Died in Martok's arms. They literally stopped the battle for him to die.
Now, we'll probably come back to that in a minute or two. But so roughly what we have for an outline for the story is, in the first book, Martok is returning to Kronos to take over his office as chancellor, and he finds himself being opposed on Kronos by another character, Morjod. And Morjod seems to have lots of power over people, and everybody just starts turning towards him, and he's spouting the go back to the traditional Klingon ways. Well, we find out that Morjod is not actually the leader, but he is being driven by his mother, Gavmara. We also learn that Morjod is the son of an illicit affair that went on between Martok and Gavmara. In this story, though, we get a little more detail about how that was, and we'll talk about that a little later. Well, we all wind up on Boreth with a big fight. In the meantime, Morjod is chasing the Rotaran through space, while the Rotaran is chasing the Sword of Kalis through space, and they want to retrieve it and bring it back to Martok to give him strength and more self-confidence to go back into the battle, which they really didn't need. Kalis has done his homework in this thing, and he has all the answers to what has happened. He knows all the stories, he's brought all the pieces together, and so they do get the Sword of Kalis, and the Rotaran heads for Boroth with Morjod and his ship behind them all the way, shooting, destroying them, taking pieces off the ship, but they're not going to give up. The Rotaran doesn't give up, and what was once a badly dishonored bird of prey turns out to be quite the stout little ship. And crash lands on Boreth. Morjod comes down to Boreth and joins the battle. Gavmara is directing the Herc, which she created from the DNA from the earlier Herc invasion. And she also added Klingon DNA, which makes them even more fierce. The battle rages on for a long time. Morjod is finally defeated. Martok gets a hold of Gavmara and beheads her, and everyone lives happily ever after.
Or so they think.
Well, you know, the thing is it's just like any other Star Trek story, where an older version of the Star Trek stories, where they write it and everything is reset back to the way it was before, so that it doesn't goof up the timeline for the TV series.
Well, actually, this doesn't have to worry about goofing up anything for the TV series. Sorella can die. Martok's two daughters can die. Nothing's going to happen. The only reason Drex, Martok's son by Sorella, has to survive is that he is going to go on to the IKS Gorkon in Keith DeCantio's book, It's a Good Day to Die. And when you say everybody lives happily ever after, we kind of know what's going to happen to Drex.
Yeah.
It's not a happily ever after.
No, it isn't. But at any rate, so you mentioned Drex.
Yes.
You want to talk a little bit about him? You've got him in our notes.
Well, okay. He's Martok's son. He's a fairly competent warrior in this book. He accomplishes many great deeds and succeeds and is going to turn into the slime that Kag doesn't care for in Decantio's book.
Yeah. Well, and that's the whole thing with Drex. He starts out being like a spoiled brat, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, well,
he loses his Datog to Worf.
Right. Well, and that, among other things, and at the beginning of this book, he's, you know, oh, well, we know what Drex is all about, and he lives up to it. But when they get to this battle on Boreth, he seems to grow up, and he seems to be able to, you know, take care of himself and hold his own.
Well, is it that he grows up, or is it that Drex is a better warrior than he is an officer?
Good point.
You know, he can be a competent warrior, do what he's told to do, succeed at what he's told to do, but not come up with the ways to go about doing it.
Yeah.
Like an officer is required to do.
Yeah. We have, you know, and then you mention also here the use of voice.
Yeah, we literally see it in this. How does Gothmora control all the Klingons? They literally mention in this book that she's using the voice. Well, we're stealing from Camelot to begin with, and now we're stealing from Dune.
I know. That absolutely was the same thought that I had as I read this. It's like, wait a minute. What do we got going on here? Is she Bene Gesserit as well as Klingon?
Well, it is possible. She could be, you know, inducted into the Bene Gesserit Academy and learned all the stuff, but she would have had to flip universes for a minute and get past the Gum Jabbar.
Yeah, because have we seen anywhere in Star Trek where this is something that has happened before?
What, flipping universes?
No.
Or
no.
The voice?
Using the voice in such a way to manipulate people.
No, I have not seen anywhere in Star Trek any character having that type of ability.
Yeah, normally it's more of a telepathic kind of a thing.
Suggestion, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, we've seen that a number of times all the way back to the original series, but, you know, this voice thing was different. When we first encounter this idea that she has the ability to manipulate people, in my mind, it was perhaps she had some sort of psionic device set up somewhere that was putting out waves, electromagnetic waves of some kind that was causing people to, you know, be in tune with her.
Or maybe they could have stole from Daredevil and Jessica Jones and had her just have the ability to affect, get people to do what they said, like the Purple Man.
Yeah.
Or better yet, they could have come up with another alternative, another method for her to have gained control, mind control of the Klingons that turned on Martok. But then you run into the thing of, okay, they have been, the Klingons that are being controlled by Gothmora are being controlled by her. They don't have control of their own thoughts, deeds, whatever. And Martok is going to remove them from any type of power structure within the new Klingon Empire because he can't trust them.
Mm-hmm.
Wait a minute. They were forced against their will, or did something else go on that we're not privy to, that they chose to go with Gothmora rather than been controlled by Gothmora? Mm-hmm. In the one case, Martok should forgive them. In the other case, Martok can't trust them. Unanswered question.
Yeah. Well, it's a thread that we'll never find the end to, I don't think.
No, probably not. Not at this point. This book is, what, 18 years old?
Yeah.
I don't think if we went up to JG and asked him about it, he'd even remember writing it. Now, he may remember writing it, but not the pity squat details. Mm. Why the hell do they have chompers in this thing? Whoever wrote this episode was an idiot.
Yeah. So one, you have in here the fight between Martok and Gothmara.
Yeah, it ends too quickly for a story, okay? But in medieval times, sword fights lasted approximately 20 seconds. Now, we've shown this in the Society for Creative Anachronisms.
Mm-hmm.
If you have two warriors that go out in a tourney and they've been trained by the same person, that fight will last because they know each other's moves. They know what to look for. They know how to react to them. But if they're not trained by the same person, one person's going to pull a trick, boom, it's over.
Plus, you know, you say it's not just because of strength, too. I'll tell you what, I have a steel batleth. I own one. It weighs 8 pounds. You're not going to swing that thing around very long before you're kind of worn out.
No. But I could take a 7-pound sword, and I can beat a guy that's got 100 pounds on me and is, you know, a good foot taller. Why? Because I got the technique on how to use it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I got tricks that I can pull. I can do a backhanded shot that comes in close but swings my arm out and around and hits him in the back of the head. I can look straight at his chest, straight at his shoulder, walk up to him, drop my arm down, take out his leg. There are tricks in sword fighting that make the technique work. There's a saying in the SCA, old and experience will beat youth and enthusiasm any day.
Yeah, and I've heard that one myself at times.
In various different ways.
Yes. Well, some of the things that I came up with in the story, and, you know, I suppose we can call it points of plot that we liked. You brought up a few. Kalis has done his homework. Now, he's pictured to us throughout, whenever he's mentioned, except for in the original series. He's mentioned that he was very intelligent, very thoughtful, and philosophical, and thought things through before he did it. And we get a picture of the clone of Kalis here, the same thing. He does his homework, learns about Gothmara, the cloned Herc, how she used old DNA and Klingon DNA to make kind of a super Herc.
And not only that, but by this time, Kalis is just beginning to become the hermit that he will in later times.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody notices him around, and he's able to get places and learn the stuff that other people can't get around and learn, because Gothmara and her allies have got their eyes focused on the leadership of the Klingon Empire that they're trying to take down.
Mm-hmm.
Kalis can get off to the side and sneak around. Well, just move around and learn this stuff.
Yeah. Well, and he not only that, we find out that Kalis is also, during the story, we find out he is not a battle-crazed nut. You know, he helped Drex survive when Drex was wounded. Actually carried him away and hid him in a place where he couldn't be harmed.
But that's Kalis. He's the first of the Klingon, the new modern Klingon warriors. And how do I say this? He still has the traits before him, before he picked up the theology almost of the warrior. So he's got the ability to pick and choose his battles rather than just go with the burning blood bloodlust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was a point that I mentioned before, the Rotaran. I mean, do you remember when that was introduced in Deep Space Nine? What a sad situation that was.
And it took Martok a while to turn it around. In fact, I believe Worf had to goad Martok into doing it.
Well, yeah, there was that exchange of the warrior's heart that they exchanged as they had in the prison camp when Worf was fighting the Jem'Hadar. But, you know, the Rotaran, a sad and dishonored ship, becomes a key point to winning the day in this book. Apparently, since J.G. was helping, was writing this book, he must have had a sentimental spot for that part of the storyline.
The Rotaran was his ship in the Cardassian War.
Mm-hmm.
The Rotaran was essentially the flagship of the Klingon Empire in the Cardassian War. It was built up, strengthened around, and was able to take on Cardassian, Jem'Hadar, and...
Yeah, and it was crewed by a bunch of misfits.
Who were only misfits because they had lost so many encounters that they didn't feel like they could win.
Well, they felt like they were on a cursed ship.
Yeah, they couldn't win.
Yeah. So we still have the King Arthur theme going on in this story.
Not as large an extent as we did in the last one. I mean, Martok beats Morjed, I think, 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
And never once does Morjed plunge a spear into Martok so that Martok can pull it into him and get to his son and kill him. And then, you know, Arthur's kid never turned into a beastie.
Yeah. Right.
Which gives me the opinion, gives me the thought, is Morjed really Martok's son? Because Gathamara had to do something to him to make him herk on the inside, herk out, so to speak, at the end of the battle. Could she have done something to taken a dead cell from Martok or something, cloned him enough to genetically engineer the creature enough to... More unanswered questions.
Well, see, that's not in the story. And, and Martok accepts that Morjed is his son. He acknowledges that in the story.
It's just that transformation at the end.
Yeah.
As he's being defeated for the third time, that throws the doubt in my mind.
Ah. Well, yeah. Gathamara, she seems to be very proficient with genetics and creating weapons, you know.
This is not the first book where the bad guy, the antagonist, has been a genetics genius.
Oh, no. Yeah, we had that with the albino.
Right.
Yeah, we had that a while back.
Or Forged in Fire, I believe.
Mm-hmm. So, but what threw doubt on the whole situation with Morjed being Martok's son, positively for me, was when Kalis explained that Martok was one in just a string of these little encounters that Gathamara had. And her main interest was to advance her position. And she wanted to make bioweapons to be sold by her dishonorable captain on the ship that her and Martok were on together. So she was corrupt to begin with, you know, and Martok was just the unfortunate one to impregnate her, apparently, and later become chancellor, making him her target.
So going back to the Dune references, are we talking about Gathamara was collecting genetic material for a Quidas Sadarak program?
No, I don't think so. She was just trying to climb the ladder and gain more power. And it didn't matter who she had her little encounters with on her way there. It was whomever could do her the most good, basically, is what we got going on. So, you know, and Martok becoming chancellor put a target on him. So... Now, the last point that I bring up, and I think both you and I agree on this one, the Ferengi Farr, which we haven't talked a lot about him yet, he comes and goes. He and Martok have some great humorous banter throughout both books. They get along very well. I love the way Martok acts like he's barely tolerating him, but likes him being around anyway. Farr is not your typical Ferengi. He is interested in making profit, but he doesn't really seem to care about the Ferengi mythos, that he would just, you know, he's just doing his own thing and trying to get by. So anyway, someone fires, I think it was Morjot, actually fired a weapon at Martok, and Farr took that bullet for Martok.
What's not explained is how Farr knew that that bullet was coming. Because in the write-up to Farr taking the bullet, he's on the move to catch up with Martok because he knows he needs to be Martok's shield again.
This is what he's been doing through in both books. He's been shielding Martok from a number of things.
Well, that's because if he didn't shield Martok, he wouldn't get paid for his truck.
Yeah, that's right. He had to get paid. I forgot about that. He had to get paid back for that vehicle he loaned to Martok.
Martok doesn't forget about it, because the very last thing he's doing towards the end of the book is sending the money for that truck to Farr's family.
Oh, yeah. Well, Martok's an honorable man. He will keep his promises and pay his debts. But now here's this little Ferengi out on Boreth fighting with Martok and dies in Martok's arms. And I don't know about you, but that hit deep inside of me.
Yeah, as I said, I was tearing up.
Yeah.
Reading that particular passage. Especially, as you say, is being admitted to Stovokor.
Yes, he asks, can I go to Stovokor?
He knows the Grand Exchequer in the sky ain't going to have him.
Well,
he's not enough of a Ferengi to pass that guy's test.
No, he's not going to.
But he's enough of a Klingon.
Yes.
To get into Stovokor.
Yes. And he gets the death howl. So that was such a heroic thing. And it was great, great writing. It was a great story point. It was everything that you would want from the unlikely hero.
Yeah.
So, and you mentioned that as your favorite point of plot. And I have to say it was mine too. I mean, there were a lot of battles. There were a lot of things that happened in the story that were great, but nothing to compare with Farr's story.
And basically, if you look at it from a writing perspective, Farr's death and Martok's reaction to Farr's death is the turning point that turns the plot story around to where Martok is going to take Morjot out and finish things up.
Yeah, and that's exactly what happens. Everything is resolved. Everything is put back the way it's supposed to be, and Martok can go and...
Not in a couple of pages. It's going to take another, 20 to 30 pages to get there.
Yes.
But...
I mean, the battles, everything was... The story was great, I thought, So you have some concepts that we can discuss.
Oh, yeah. And I was just thinking of another one since I was writing this, too, is the Klingon Empire has to rebuild itself to root out the corruption, to make their lives better for all members of their race, not bringing back to reality the 1% or the richest members of our society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and that's usually the way it goes. We know Gowron started out being very honorable. His intentions were to rule the Empire and make it greater by deeds and governing evenly. And what he wound up doing was he wound up becoming a politician.
Just like his predecessor, who had to discommodate Worf to keep, Duras. Duras's indiscretions on the planet from being revealed.
Right. And, you know, embarrassing the Empire, basically. And so, and so Worf had no choice but to eliminate him because he was not living up to what...
In this case, we're talking about Gowron.
Right.
Not the previous.
Yeah. And we had to take him out because he would have led the Empire to ruin. He would have divided the Empire. Probably
worse than that,
fractured it.
Worf took him out because Gowron was leading the Empire to defeat in the Cardassian War because he wanted to make sure Martok did not become the victorious general to come back to Rome and be named emperor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They use those last things, you know, historically rather than canonically from Star Trek.
Yeah. So one of the concepts that stood out to me was how past indiscretions will always come back and bite you in the arse.
Yeah. If you don't study history, I'm not going to finish that because I very few people that I know of have failed their courses in history and been doomed to retake the damn course, which is what they should do.
Yeah.
If you fail to learn from history, take the damn course again.
Yeah. But no, I mean, and that's speaking in general, but I mean in a specific, more of an individual position. When you do something and you don't think about it at first, it's going to come back. The consequences are going to come back and get you. Everything seems to be about consequences of things that a person does.
If you look at the majority of literature and the majority of B.E. science fiction movies, it's typically a unsuspected, unplanned for, unseen consequence of something that's being done that causes the problem that has to be resolved in the book or movie.
I guess the best advice that comes from that is before you do something, think about what might happen after you do that. You know?
Yep.
Which is something that, you know, as a teacher, I mention that to kids, about 30 times a day.
I mean, how many times have you seen recently in movies and in books, the scientist that develops a brand new technique, a brand new device, a brand new something, and all of a sudden they've got to worry about what the military is going to do with their invention.
Oh, yeah. Well, isn't that one of the dilemmas Oppenheimer had with the Manhattan Project?
Yeah. You know,
he was looking for ways to use thermonuclear energy to benefit mankind, and it wound up being something that was a weapon of mass destruction, and that would be hard to live with.
Yeah. I'm not exactly sure. Didn't Oppenheimer commit suicide?
You know, I couldn't address that. I don't know for sure.
They keep comparing him and his reaction to the bomb to another scientist whose name drops my mind. But that other scientist is now known as the father of the H-bomb because he was bomb him.
Yeah. Yeah. I couldn't imagine inventing something with the intention of it doing one thing and then wind up getting used for something else.
Well, actually, Oppenheimer was working on developing a bomb.
Mm-hmm.
That is what he was doing. They'd already split the atom in a reactor in Fermi Labs within the decade prior to the Manhattan Project.
I see.
So, yeah, it's not only that he was developing something that could be used as a bomb. He was developing something that was supposed to be a bomb.
I see.
I mean, that's what the whole Manhattan Project was about. Hitler's going to have this bomb. We got to get it before he does.
Yeah. So did Oppenheimer just not realize the power?
The power.
That he had harnessed?
He saw the destructive capacity of his device is what broke him.
Oh, I see. Okay. So, let's see. We got a couple of themes to talk about. And I think we might have covered this just a little bit. When does the old leadership, Kalis, need to step back for the new leaders, Martok, to come to the forefront?
No, I don't think we've talked about this particular theme. It's a problem we're having right now in this country. When do the old leaders, the aged leaders, the leaders that have had their time in the sun, have done what they can do to move the country forward, to move the empire forward, need to look to new leadership, new ideas, let them take over and do their thing?
How long do you stay in power before you have to hand it off to younger people?
I think that depends on, and in my mind, that depends on how your ideas are formed. Are you one of those people who is able to look at a issue and come up with new and original ideas, something that hasn't been tried before, and be willing to put them in place to get them to work? Or are you going to keep trying the same old trickle-down economics that hasn't worked since Hoover?
Yeah, I don't know. And,
so if you're willing, if your mind is flexible enough to keep coming up with new ideas, you're not an old leader. But if your mind is stagnated and you can't think of new ways to do things, you're an old leader. You need to step aside and let new ideas come to the forefront.
So, yes, we find out also in this one theme we got is that, hey, Ferengis can be heroes too.
I think there was actually an episode in DS9 where you had the basically Ferengi 7 going to rescue.
Yes.
Quark's mother.
Yes. Episode with Iggy Pop.
But yeah, it was pretty much based on the Magnificent Seven again. But
well, it was called the Magnificent Ferengi.
Yeah.
Yes.
So when thrown into a mix of actual warriors, you're seeing some Ferengi being able to hold their own. I think in that episode, wasn't there one Ferengi that actually could have easily been a Klingon?
Well, there was one that acted like he was an assassin, one of them, and that's all he thought about was killing people. But
yeah,
I don't know. So, and well, one of the themes that stood out to me throughout this whole thing was overcoming self-doubt. You know, you doubt yourself, things happen to you, you're down on your luck, and it seems to be kind of a slippery slope. You fall down and you may not come back from it without help. Fortunately for Martok in this story, he's got plenty of help around him. He's got Worf, he's got Ezri Dax, he has Kalis, he has Farr.
He's got Drax, he's got Alexander, he's got Sirella, he's got the servant.
Yeah, the Gintok.
Dr. Or something.
The Gintok, yeah, I can't remember his name, but the Gintok that very present throughout there.
I've always wondered about that. That's an interesting name for the head servant.
Okay.
Because it's also the name of a Klingon spear.
Ah.
A Gintok is the spear that they were using on the planet where the Romulans were incarcerating the Klingons, and they were throwing it through a hoop.
Okay, so it's there's a symbolism here that we're thinking about where the Gintok would actually, as a person, would be the house's spear, the person that you would go to for defense. And
if you're looking for similes like that, yeah, could be. But there are a lot of words in Klingon that have different meanings. If it's used as a verb, it has one meaning. If it's used as a noun, it has a different meaning. It's just that in this case, both usages of the word are nouns. But one's a person and one's an object. And Chris, if you're listening to this, you can correct me.
Yeah, you can. You're welcome to help us out. So, well, anyway, My closing thought in this, it's a good series of books. Both books are excellent and well worth the read. You mentioned in the last...
Read them together.
Yeah, read both. But you mentioned in the last show that you could hear JG's voice throughout these books, and you definitely can. JG was not just pitching ideas at Jeffrey Lang. This really, really feels like a full collaboration between two creative minds.
Easily. Whether it was a matter of they lived close enough together that they could come together and work, or they did like Larry Niven and Jerry Purnell. They sat down, wrote up a whole bunch of notes, and then the junior partner would put the story together for the senior partner to edit, or like some collaborations do, you A writes one chapter, B writes the next, A writes the third chapter, and you just keep going like that.
So yeah, there it is. Good series of books, both of them. Read them both in order, please. They're worth it. Okay, so for the next time on Bound by Honor, we're going to take a look at a book called The Klingon Gambit by Robert E. Vardaman.
It's one of the really early Star Trek novels.
Yes, it's a TOS novel. We haven't...
Because I don't think Next Generation had even been aired yet.
No, not at all.
This one was written.
Not at all. We're going back again. We've kind of moved forward a lot, and we left some of those older books behind. We've been doing the more modern ones by more recent authors. And so I think it's time to step back and look at something older again and talk about that.
Remember, to us old fogies, 18 years, which is how old this book is, ain't that long ago.
No. So, go out there. You're listening to us, I hope. You go out there. Tell everybody about us. Tell them where to find us on Apple Podcasts, on our website, kag.org/podcast. You can find us there. We're right on the front page of KAG also. Get out there and give us a pitch, and you might even go over to Apple Podcasts and give us a review if you feel it's worthy. 5 stars would be nice. It'll get us up there in the ratings. We'll be able to make more shows and do things like that. If you have any suggestions for books, we have a list, and we're starting to rapidly run out of things to talk about. So if you want us to continue and you know some Klingon stories out there that we can talk about, you might drop us a note about that too. So, for Bound by Honor, I am Jajim.
And I am Jorn.
And join us next time for another Klingon book review.
Kapla!
You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group book review podcast. Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kirk Zantai Loon Keej. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.kag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon. Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@kag.org. Kapla!
There, what is
our show?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.